With me is Helen Caldicott, who has been one of the most outspoken and eloquent people in America in the fight against the nuclear arms race, nuclear weapons, and nuclear power. When the French were conducting atmospheric testing in the South Pacific near her native Australia, she led the successful fight in Australia against continued testing. Since moving to America in the mid-70s, she's been working to inform the American public of the biological effects of radiation. She lives in Boston, where she's a pediatrician at Boston Children's Medical Center. She's also the president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She's in Philadelphia today to address the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom on the occasion of their 65th anniversary. In a few minutes on Fresh Air, we'll be opening up the phones for your questions and comments for Helen Caldicott. Helen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
When we were talking, when you first got here before the show started, you were telling me that you just got back from a conference, well, from a visit to Europe, a very disturbing visit for you. You were telling me that there's quite an alarmist atmosphere now about the possibility of nuclear war. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
Yeah. I was there for 2.5 weeks, and I visited Amsterdam, Utrecht in Holland, Brussels, Berlin, Hamburg in West Germany, and all over Britain. And what I found was that certainly in England, there's a shelter boom. There are 300 firms that are now building and selling shelters to people. The government, the Thatcher government, is going around to all the little towns and cities, teaching people how to survive a nuclear war. They've got a book published called Protect and Survive, and it says in a nuclear war you pull the curtains and you get some sandbags over the door and you hide under the door and don't forget to take the cat's food down to the cellar with you. People are very confused. They know, they think they know the government's lying, but more than that, there's a tremendous fear. And I found that throughout Europe as well. People are starting to build shelters in Europe. The Europeans are very frightened that Ronald Reagan may be elected, but they're frightened generally of the situation. They're frightened of the cruise missiles that America wants to deploy in Europe, because they say that the cruise missiles are strategic weapons. They can go from one continent to another, Europe to the Soviet Union, and that makes them the target of nuclear war. And they've been told by America that that means America won't participate in a nuclear war. The theatre will be Europe, and of course Europe will be obliterated. But it was a very strange feeling to look back at this country from Europe and know that people there are very aware of the reality of the situation, and most Americans have little or no idea or are totally blocking what's about to happen, probably, because there are various scientists in this country now, including George Kistikowski, who was Eisenhower's science advisor, who are thinking there'll be a nuclear war by 1990. And apparently the Joint Chiefs of Staff say there's a 50-50 chance of one by 1985. And not to look at this realistically and be frightened about it and anxious and do something about it is not very mentally healthy, because, in fact, our strongest instinct is that of survival. And particularly for women with children, I mean, that's a very potent instinct, making sure your children survive. And we must wake up and we must get moving, and we can certainly stop it if we do. But if we don't, almost inevitably it will happen.
Now, in Europe, you were saying that people there are really afraid of America and see America as being possibly like the force in starting a nuclear war. What is their fear specifically of America? Is it the possibility of Reagan getting elected? Is it the conflict between us and Iran now that's...
Yes, it's the whole thing. It probably began with Iran and worsened with Afghanistan, not just what the Russians did, but the American reaction to it, that Secretary of Defense Brown and Carter were threatening for the first time ever in history overtly to use tactical nuclear weapons against Russia. And that almost certainly would be a Holocaust. And I'll get on to talking about the medical effects of that Holocaust in a little while. European soil is covered with American weapons at the moment. There are over 5,000 tactical nuclear weapons in West Germany. Tactical weapons are those that are put in an aeroplane, flown across to the Soviet Union and dropped. They're exactly the same as strategic weapons, only strategic weapons are in a missile, so you press a button and the rocket goes off. But it's the same thing. The warhead is the same. They're very big, much bigger, many of them, well, about the same size or bigger than the one China just tested. The cruise missiles are very important. America wants to deploy 572 cruise missiles and Pershing 2 missiles, and I'll explain what they mean. The cruise are strategic. They go in rockets.
And they are supposed to evade radar because they go very close to the ground. There's some doubt as to whether they will work. Many of the weapons, the cruise missiles they've been testing in California, keep crashing all the time. But anyway, once they're deployed, they're very tiny, and you can't see them from a satellite. The reason why we've got SALT II, Strategic Arms Limitation Agreement, if it was signed and ratified by America, which it hasn't been, is that both sides can see each other's strategic weapons, and so there's no trust involved. They say, we know how many you've got, we know how many we've got, you know, we can have an agreement. Once crews are deployed, that's the end of arms control. That is the end of SALT talks. And you see, I don't think very many Americans at all understand the extremely significant point that they will play in radically altering the nature of the arms race. Now, the second thing is the Pershing 2 missiles, they get to Moscow in about 4 minutes from Europe, which means that the Russians are going to have to respond within 4 minutes. Now, that requires a system called launch on warning. In fact, the Russians are way behind in developing this, but America will have it within 2 or 3 years. It's computerized warfare. It means that America will be able to launch weapons within 3 or 4 minutes by a computer, and there will be no human input. Now, if people really understand what that means, you know, at the moment it takes 20 minutes to launch a nuclear war. It'll be 3 minutes with no human control, not even the president.
Well, I have to say that people are usually afraid of computers as far as dealing with their telephone bills or their gas bills, because sometimes you find out that you got the wrong bill or you would charge the wrong amount, and it's going to take 3 months because they have to re-input the computer. Yeah. So I'm sure that the distrust of a computer amongst the public is very great nuclear weapons.
We nearly had nuclear war 3 times in the last 9 months, because in November last year, a man plugged a war games tape into the fail-safe computer in the Pentagon. It made a mistake and detected missiles coming from Russia. The whole world went on nuclear alert for 6 whole minutes. At the 7th, the president was to be notified, but they couldn't find him. 3 squadrons of planes took off armed with nuclear weapons, and if it had proceeded for another 14 minutes, the thing would have gone into action and we would be extinct. And there were 2 more occasions in June this year when a 46-cent chip in the computer failed. And that happened twice, and we were on alert for 3 minutes. Now, in 3 years or so, you see, that'll be the end of us. You know, for me as a pediatrician and a mother, I'm really quite frantic. I don't know how to get people here to understand what war would mean. Certainly, when I spoke to a lot of European audiences, and I've spent the past 2 weeks speaking all over Europe, when I mention war, the look of horror on their faces is just incredible. I have to really work hard to get people here to understand the horror of what a war would mean.
Do you think that's because World War I and World War II was fought on European soil and not on American soil?
Of course, of course.
You know, particularly when the crisis in Iran started and when the hostages were taken, all the news people were out on the streets doing men on the street type interviews, and it was every day when you turn on the news in the evening, someone would say, "I say, drop the bomb." What were you thinking then? I'm sure you were thinking of ways to reach people who were thinking in those terms, yeah, whose reaction to a conflict was, okay, let's drop it.
What it means is that the people here innately don't understand what dropping the bomb means. What they should know is dropping one bomb on Russia will start the war. Now, what does that mean? It means that America has, a Secretary of Defense McNamara estimated in the 60s, if America had about 200 hydrogen bombs, that would be enough to kill 1/3 of the Russian people, if that's what you so desired, which is grossly amoral, because one of the 10 commandments is, thou shalt not kill, and destroy 2/3 of their population. And that would be an adequate deterrent, 200. Today, America has 30 to 35,000 hydrogen bombs. They have enough to overkill every Russian human being 40 times. And Russia has about 20,000 hydrogen bombs. They have enough to overkill every American human being about 20 times. And what would it mean if there was a war? Well, everyone should know it takes about 20 minutes for both sides to finish the war. Because say the button's pressed here or in the Soviet Union, doesn't matter much. There's no real aggressor in 20 minutes, let's face it. The weapons go out into space, re-enter the Earth's atmosphere at 20 times the speed of sound, and land pretty accurately on their targets. Meanwhile, the other country's done the same thing. So the whole thing will be over in about 20 minutes to half an hour. People should know, according to the Department of Civil Defense here, every town and city with a population of 25,000 people or more is targeted. So also are the nuclear reactors. A single 1 megaton bomb dropping on a 1,000 megawatt reactor would wipe out Pennsylvania, disappear. The airports are targeted, the oil refineries, and the same in the Soviet Union, in Europe, in Britain, and maybe China. So that we had just had a symposium on the medical consequences of thermonuclear war held in New York, sponsored by Albert Einstein and Columbia Schools of Medicine, at which Cyrus Vance spoke. And it was opened by the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, Howard Hyatt. And what came out of that symposium was that within 30 days after a nuclear war, 90% of Americans will be dead. And after that, most others will die. Because, you see, if you're in a shelter in a targeted area, a 20-megaton bomb would create a firestorm of 3,000 square miles in area, and it would use up all the oxygen, and you'd be asphyxiated or pressure cooked. So everyone has to know that most areas are targeted where people live. If you happen to get to a shelter in a rural area that's not targeted, you'll only have 20 minutes notice. You'll have to be listening to the radio to know to run there. You can't come out for 2 weeks because the fallout is so intense that you'd die. And this would be the scene ecologically when you came out. We think that much of the ozone layer will be destroyed, thereby letting a lot of radiation coming in from the sun, so white-skinned people will only be able to stay in the sun for 3 minutes or so before they develop third-degree sunburn and become blind. The fallout will still be intense. And remember, in Hiroshima, there was an outside world to come in and help. In this instance, there will be nothing. Civilization, as we know it, will be gone. What's more, there'll be no doctors, or very few. There'll be no hospitals to help the survivors because we're targeted. People should know that at the moment, President Jimmy Carter is stockpiling huge quantities of opium just in case there's a nuclear war. What does that mean? That means if any of us, doctors, survive, we know if there are any syringes and we know where the opium is stockpiled, we'll be able to inject it into the people to help them die. There'll be millions and millions of dead, decaying bodies, with bacteria and viruses mutating to become more virulent, and our immune mechanism will be depleted by the radiation, and so therefore there'll be epidemics of all the diseases we now control: plague, typhoid, polio, dysentery, and all the rest. There'll be no food, of course, the water, if there is any, most water supplies will be destroyed, but if there is any, will be grossly contaminated. It was Nikita Khrushchev who said, years ago, in the event of a nuclear war, the living will envy the dead. And what we're doing is we're moving rapidly towards a nuclear war. SALT II has not been ratified. That is not for the benefit of the Russians. That's for the benefit of the world, including the Americans, every human being on Earth, because it slows down a little bit the arms race. Must be followed rapidly by SALT III. Medically, those weapons are biologically unacceptable. And interestingly, the international community has outlawed biological and chemical warfare. Somehow, these things have got under the bridge. The dean of the Harvard School of Public Health says nuclear war would be the final epidemic. And the medical axiom is, if you have an incurable disease, the only recourse is prevention. And so therefore, I'm now president of the Physicians for Social Responsibility. We have 2,000 doctors, more joining every day. And what we hope to do is educate the people, particularly in this country, about the sort of thing that they're creating by paying their taxes and allowing 56 cents out of every federal tax dollar to be used by Bendix washing machine to make hydrogen bombs, General Electric, Union Carbide, Boeing make cruise missiles. They're all in it. And they should also know that we're negotiating with Soviet physicians, including Leonid Brezhnev's doctor, Dr. Chazov, deans of medical schools throughout this country, and Hiroshima physicians, to hold a conference on the same subject to be held in Washington, D.C. next March. We see this as a medical problem, the ultimate in preventive medicine. And Dr. Brezhnev's doctor said the other day, he said, The politicians are our patients. So really what we must do is educate the people of the world fast.
Listen, politicians don't seem to have the sense of dread and fear and of what's going to happen, of the consequences that you're talking to us about now. One wonders if the presidential candidates are aware of the explicit magnitude of nuclear war that you're discussing with us, and if they feel the imminence that you're describing, that Europeans feel, and that I know many Americans feel. What's your evaluation of people who have political power and who are responsible for these negotiations and for the ultimate decision-making? Do you think they're naive, uninformed, stupid, evil?
I think they're ignorant. A little bit of all those things. The people who go into politics usually enjoy power. And the trouble is that the people in this country, what's happened is that technology has moved so fast and so rapidly, science, that the people, the ordinary people, including the politicians, don't really understand it. And it's the scientists who I think I blame most, because they create these incredible weapons of mass destruction. The whole world is wired up with satellites from the sky. They can almost count the hairs on our head. They can almost read the number plates on cars. All ready to go. It's like having a bomb wired up, ready to go. And these scientists sit at MIT and most of the universities in this country, funded by the Pentagon, developing these incredible weapons of genocide, which are evil and wicked. And they take no responsibility for it, but they get a lot of money for doing it, their grants, and they write papers and they make the weapons. Then the politicians and industry and the Pentagon take these weapons and develop a rationale politically for using them. That's what's happened with the MX, with the cruise missile, with the Trident, with all the rest. And so I would place the blame, I think, at the doorstep of these scientists. Over half the scientists in this country work for the military-industrial complex. The world spends $600 billion a year on arms, and two-thirds of the world's children are starving and malnourished.
So you're not criticizing pure research. You're criticizing the people specifically who are working for the military and for...
Well, unfortunately, much pure research is done in the cause of war. But you see, we have the technology to help most people in the world, the overpopulation problem, the food problem, the starvation, the medical problem in the world. What on earth are we doing? What on earth are we doing when we are the curators now of every organism on earth? We're so brilliant, we've learned how to destroy it, and we seem to be rushing like lemmings towards that end within the next decade or two.
My guest is Helen Caldicott, if you're just joining us, and she's been working against nuclear weapons and nuclear power for the last decade. She was very active in Australia, where she's credited with nearly single-handedly alerting the Australians to the problem of atmospheric testing being conducted by the French, and also the exportation of uranium, which she united labor in Australia to organize against the unnecessary mining and exporting of uranium. Helen, the last time I heard you speak was about, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks ago on the Sunday edition of All Things Considered, and it was a report about one of the conferences that you just held in New York, the one that you mentioned a few minutes ago, and it was on the medical consequences of nuclear war. And I'd heard excerpts of a similar symposium that you organized in Boston. We broadcast part of that on this show. And particularly after the time I heard you about 3 weeks ago on All Things Considered, I was really anxious that whole night because somehow the imminence of nuclear war seems so much greater, and I feel that a lot of people are much more worried and anxious than they've been in many, many years. Mm. But so what can I do? I was anxious all night. I did my work. I cleaned up the house, and I felt anxious and tried to say, well, okay, what are you going to do with this anxiety? Now, what can someone do? We can take aspirin to cope with a headache caused by anxiety, but anxiety only goes so far. It doesn't necessarily provoke action. What kind of action do you think individuals can do?
Well, I'll give an example of my life. I read On the Beach when I was 15, and I lived in Melbourne. That was about a nuclear war that occurred by accident. Everyone died in the north, and gradually the radioactive cloud moved down to the southern hemisphere. The only people left alive in the world were people in Melbourne, and then eventually they died. My anxiety has provoked anger, which I think I've used constructively to stop it. Now, you know, it's really not up to me to tell Americans how to use their democracy. People would literally give their eyesight in most countries in the world to have a democracy, and a democracy means that you control your own country. People have to realize they're not children anymore being protected, but they are in fact adults with the total responsibility of this world on their own shoulders and nobody else. You can blame nobody but yourself for what has happened, really, because if you've been passive, that's the way evil flourishes. And evil must not flourish in a democracy. This is a wonderful country, and somehow it's lost its way. It's somehow lost its way. It's developed enough weapons now to overkill every person on Earth about 12 times. That's not the sort of basis that the Constitution was based upon. I think it's greed, too, because the companies who make the weapons make a lot of money out of it, but it's also creating a lot of inflation. Now, I have got a few suggestions, but take them or leave them. You may not want to accept them. You may want to do your own thing. You can join Women's International League for Peace and Freedom here in Philadelphia, which is a wonderful organization. I have started the Women's Party for Survival. What I would like to do is put an ad on General Hospital, which is watched by millions of women. A 30-second ad talking as a mother and a doctor about how I feel about nuclear war and how imminent it is and how it'll be 20 minutes and that's it. And recruit millions of women. Now, what we've got to do is start holding town meetings and get back to the old democratic system. And women can lead that in a way because we understand the genesis of life, even if we've never had a baby. That instinct to protect life must be probably the most powerful instinct that we have. It's because of that instinct that we've survived. What also we must do is organize the schools to start teaching the kids. We must get into the churches who are morally out of it at the moment, the ministers, the priests and the rabbis. This is the ultimate religious question. What's our responsibility to God to continue evolution? We must also go and see our congressmen and senators once a week, delegations of women and men. This I'm talking about the positive feminine principle of nurturing and loving and caring. And put the babies on their desks, maybe change the diaper, and say, are you representing this baby? And they're not. They're not. They're not representing life. They're representing death. I think that could be very powerful if applied throughout this country. Also, you can support Physicians for Social Responsibility if you would like to do that. You can write to 56 North Beacon Street, Watertown, Boston. You can become an associate member. We've got a lot of literature. We've got the tapes from those conferences on the medical effects of nuclear war. We need helpers to start our chapters throughout the country. We have 37 chapters now who are working very hard. So that may be another way people can help. If you want to join the Women's Party, you can write to me, care of that address again, PSR 56 North Beacon Street, Watertown. There are lots of peace groups throughout the country, but what we all have to realize is this, that so far what any of us have done has had no effect on the arms race. And if we want to survive and the Earth to continue, and it may be the only life in the whole universe, we have to do something very radical. I'm not talking about killing people. I'm talking about radical for life, because this is really the most conservative issue that you could think about. It's for conserving life. And, you know, people are meant to take risks during war. Soldiers are. If they're not, they're not courageous. They might get shot if they run away. Somehow, we think, we've been conditioned to think, we mustn't take risks for peace. Well, now, in the past, when there were little wars, it mightn't have mattered. But now, there's no other issue that matters. It doesn't matter if the kids clean their teeth at night, if you give them good, nutritious food, if you develop a good, loving relationship with your husband or with your wife for their sake, if, in fact, they're not going to live for another 10 or 20 years.
Helen, I'd like to invite our listeners to call up with any questions that they'd like to ask you. My guest is Helen Caldicott, and she's been one of the most eloquent and outspoken people in the country against nuclear weapons, nuclear war, and nuclear power. She was also very outspoken in her native Australia and led the people there in a fight against atmospheric testing being conducted by the French. If you have any questions you'd like to ask her, our phones are open, and the number is 923-2774. So again, at area code 215, the number is 923-2774, and our phones are open. One of the organizing tactics that you used in Australia was to try to unite labor. And one of the causes you united them around was the exportation of uranium, which was going to be used for nuclear weapons or nuclear power. Now, what kind of contacts have you had with American labor? Have you found the labor unions and other labor groups to be interested in the issues that you're discussing? Is there any way of because it's such a large group of people who are already organized together?
Yeah. Unfortunately, only 25% of the workers here are unionized, whereas in Australia, 75% of them are. But yes, we are working with labor unions now. The physicians are going out to speak to them. The meat cutters union is getting involved. Certainly the William Wimpensinger's machinist union are very involved. The automotive workers are involved. It's just a lot of grassroots educational stuff that we have to do, and it takes a lot of energy and time, and doctors are doing it already. So that's another area. But because most workers are not unionized, we have to do it, I think, differently than we did it in Australia. And we have to use the media, because the media is the single most important influence in this country. That television controls the thinking and expectations and understandings of most Americans, and so often it doesn't tell them what they really should be hearing about the truth.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones. Our phone lines are all lit. My guest is Helen Caldicott, and the phones are open. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. First of all, Terry, I'd like to thank Dr. Caldicott for her work and for providing us with this information. I'd also like to ask her, I have been doing some reading for several years about this and studying up on it, but I would like her, before the program ends today, to give the name of the group and the address in Watertown again so that we can all get it down.
Okay. First, you can join Women's International League for Peace and Freedom here in Philadelphia, who are a fine group of women who've been working on this for 65 years. Secondly, you can join the Women's Party for Survival, or Physicians for Social Responsibility, who have a lot of literature, by writing to 56 North Beacon Street, B-E-A-C-O-N, Watertown, Massachusetts.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That's a pleasure.
Thanks very much for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I would like to ask about the issue of the buildup being a result of a deterrent factor, and whether, just where that rationale has come from.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I guess I don't really understand it myself. There's a sort of schizophrenic rift or separation between reality and the perception of reality, and they perceive reality to be that the more weapons they have, the more they'll deter war. Now, that was certainly true in the past with conventional weapons. If you had more weapons, you could literally wipe out your neighbor. But this time, the more weapons you have, the more totally insecure you become, the more the technology becomes so fragile and so sophisticated that they can launch war in 3 minutes by computers, the more totally, totally insecure the whole world is. And I think people should know that 92% of the world's people don't live in either Russia or America and really care little about the sort of five-year-old little boy competitive arguments that are going on. And they feel very strongly about that.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
I'm a college student, Westchester State, about 30 miles west of Philadelphia, and I'd like to know what type of literature I could disseminate or what type of action I could take to facilitate knowledge on campus about nuclear war.
Okay, you can write to me at the address we just gave, 56 North Beacon Street, Watertown, Mass. Address it to me, Dr. Helen Caldicott. Say that you're a college student and you want literature, and we'll send you back stuff. There might be a little bill with it, but it's not much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to ask the following, or make the following comment. I watch, because I work at home, I watch sometimes the evangelicals during the day, and I've been shocked to see that they are actually sort of encouraging people. They claim that the growing confusion and the events that are happening now are prophesied, and that that people should really be looking forward to the perhaps the coming war is Armageddon, and I was really been left speechless on a couple occasions, because these people really seem to be almost egging people on.
It's interesting. I've heard evangelical radio stations discussing, people on those stations discussing the importance of nuclear power and how people are against it are anti-American, but I haven't heard what you're describing. Have you heard that, Helen?
Yeah, I know that one of their platforms is certainly to build more weapons, and I've heard that they justify it with the Bible and that if there is an Armageddon, that's great. Well, all I can say is that Christ, if Christ came back to the earth right now, he would be absolutely shocked and he'd be one of the most radical people that we can imagine.
Let me ask you, have you tried to speak with any of the leaders of that movement or the people who are within that movement and try to use your logic and reasoning and evidence and facts to counteract
what they're
saying?
Well, I've been terribly busy the last 2 years, but that's what we certainly must do. The doctors must get on those programs and speak only as doctors. And just speak about the medical effects of a nuclear war so people understand. Now, this is a democracy. Maybe people, once they know, might decide they want a nuclear war. I guess that's their prerogative. It's certainly not mine. But our responsibility would be to educate people about the effects and that probably no one will survive.
I also wanted to ask, do you place any credence in the reports that supposedly the Soviet planners do intend to somehow survive, that they believe that a war can be survived?
No, I visited the Soviet Union in September with a group from the American Friends Service Committee with some very intelligent, well-informed Americans. And although they are very keen about nuclear power, they're uniformly shocked about what's happening with weapons, although they're responsible too because they're building them. But they educate their children in schools about nuclear war. So in fact, if you talk to most Russians just walking around the streets, which is what we did, they know what a nuclear war would mean. They just laugh when you talk about civil defense. And we spoke to over 100 top Russian government officials, including the two men who negotiated SALT II for 7 years. And they say civil defense is ridiculous, which is scientifically and medically a fact.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
I'm glad to hear someone expressing your point of view, and I think I share with you your sentiment that we do not want a nuclear war to wipe out life on planet Earth. I think both we and the Soviets have better things to do than wipe each other out. And I don't have quite as personal knowledge of the Soviet Union and its people as you seem to indicate you have in the previous question you've asked, but given the what limited knowledge I do have, which comes from the news media, which comes from my service in Vietnam, and personal contact with the communists, and in my own reading and publications, I seem to get the feeling that you are advocating you are saying that deterrence can be dismissed only as mutual insecurity, which may or may not be true. I think one other person who is more technically, I do have confidence in one person who is a little more technically oriented than I am, who equated the situation with two houses which are full of ammunition and both of which can be set off by a stray bullet. But if you can't deliver the ammunition to the other person's house, it is no good at all. And as I hear you talking about lacking of a cruise missile, I hear you and some of the Pershing missiles, etc. I agree. As I look at these, I think to myself, hey, this is stupid. We should disarm. But I think we've tried the policy of unilateral disarmament, which is, in effect, I think, if I'm understanding you correctly...
I want to ask you to just get to your point and wrap it up so we can also talk some more.
My point is what I'm just saying. All of these actions which you express are working through our democracy to affect what I see as unilateral disarmament. How would you affect the other side to join the same process?
Well, in fact, America hasn't worked for unilateral disarmament. It's true that for years America has been miles ahead of the Soviet Union, and to confirm that, there's a man called Jerome Wiesner who is just now retiring as president of MIT. And he negotiated the partial test ban treaty between Khrushchev and Kennedy and has been in this for years and years, including building the weapons. And he said to me the other day, for years, the United States has been conducting an arms race with itself and it's finally managed to drag in the Russians. You should understand now at this point, the Soviet Union has signed SALT II and America has not ratified it.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your call.
I want to mention at this point also that people can contact Mobilization for Survival. The headquarters is here in Philadelphia. They're a wonderful group of people who are really the umbrella group for the peace groups throughout the United States. Get in there and help them. They're doing marvelous things as well. There are lots and lots of things you can do.
My guest is Helen Caldicott. We're talking about the effects of nuclear weapons, nuclear war. This is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
I work with the senior adults, and we are presently holding conferences to present important issues in Washington. How can we motivate senior adults to take part in this, which I think is very important?
Well, I know that the Grey Panthers are working or interested in this, certainly Maggie Kuhn. If you would like, if you organize conferences of senior adults around the United States, you contact Physicians for Social Responsibility in Boston, and we will send you speakers.
Oh, you will?
Yeah, we will. That's what we do. We have now a lot of doctors who are going out speaking, who've been trained to speak about the medical consequences. And I'll just give you the number, 617-924-3468.
3468. And this is called the Physicians
for Social Responsibility.
And this is in Boston.
Yeah, and that goes for everybody listening to this program. If you can organize big groups of people, be it churches, schools, mothers.
Well, I do work in with a large group, and
yeah.
Could we? But this would be for senior adults. Could you at this point show how it would be advantageous to how we could get senior adults activated in this issue as one of the important issues for their own concern?
You mean if we spoke to them?
Yes,
if,
I mean,
yeah.
Or even right now to get started on it. We are in the midst of having conferences.
Well, then you get the conferences together and then we'll send the speakers. And the only, it's very easy to activate senior adults because they're usually grandparents and they really love their grandchildren. And we're talking about their grandchildren surviving. That's very easy.
I would like to see this one of the issues brought to the Washington Conference.
Absolutely. I think it's the most important issue facing the human race.
I agree. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your call. Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
My name is Don Price. I saw a film, a British film, about 10 years ago called The War Games. It was photographed in a semi-documentary form and told the Holocaust story in a way that audiences could understand the horror and terror of it. A suggestion, if that film could be put on television, I think the American people could understand this thing that there's so much apathy about now.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. That was made about 20 years ago by the BBC and interestingly was never shown on the BBC. I did hear lately that PBS is going to show it, but if it's not, I think every person listening to this program should call PBS as soon as it's finished and tell them that War Games should be put on. Apparently, it's incredibly moving. It's about a nuclear weapon dropping on London.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't, but I could describe a little bit about what happens. Maybe that would be relevant. A 20-megaton bomb dropping on, say, Philadelphia would do this. And remember, this is just one bomb, and there are hundreds of tens of thousands. It would form a crater half a mile wide and 300 feet deep. So everyone, everything in that area or volume would be turned into radioactive fallout. Every person and building out to a radius of 6 miles would be vaporized. Every person out to a radius of 20 miles from the epicenter would be either killed or lethally injured. Anybody looking at the bomb out to 40 miles away would be blinded by retinal burns and have their eardrums burst from the blast, so they'd be deafened as well. And I already said it forms a firestorm 3,000 square miles, so if you're in a shelter, you'd be killed as well. So you can imagine that happening across the United States of America and across every major civilized country in the Northern Hemisphere, what that would do.
Okay, well, thank you for your phone call.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
This is getting to be a pretty terrifying conversation. It's so scary to listen to you talk, Helen. I'm sure you know that, and you've been saying these words to people around the country and probably around the world as well, and watching the terror on people's faces. How useful is fear? Now, what I mean by that is, in your campaigns around the world. I've heard some like media specialists say that to a certain extent, fear isn't useful. It's immobilizing, and it makes you feel helpless and impotent.
I don't think that's true. You know, when parents, first of all, I must point out that emotion is normal. And what science and industry have done is taught us that we mustn't feel emotional. And if we're emotional, where people say, well, we're, you know, just women, or you're just emotional and you're discredited. The analogy I use to destroy that argument is this. If I have two parents in my office and I tell them their child has leukemia or cystic fibrosis and they show no emotional reaction, I get them a psychiatrist immediately. If we're not fearful of our present situation, we're sublimating our strongest physiological instinct, which is survival, and that's mentally not healthy. We have to be passionate about our survival, and the way to help your fear is this. You do something about it. You try and stop it. If two parents have a child with leukemia, what they often do is fundraise to get money to help with the cure for leukemia. What we must all do is try and stop this thing. If we all move fast, millions of people, of course we can stop it. That's obvious. And, you know, you'd have reason to feel depressed if you, every one of us had felt we'd done everything we could to stop this. And if you ask yourself, what have I done? I've really done nothing. And it's really for my children that I have to do this, then there's cause for tremendous optimism. We own the government. We pay for them. They're our servants. They must do what we tell them. The reason they're not doing what we tell them is because we're not telling them what to do.
Many people feel that they don't have much of a choice in the upcoming election and don't really know how to use their vote for the benefit of world peace. What's your analysis of the people who are running? Do you feel that any one candidate is stronger than the other?
Well, I think Barry Commoner says wonderful things, and he's a good person, and maybe if people don't know who to vote for, they should vote for Commoner. If he gets 5% of the vote, he gets his federal money, which he deserves. He's speaking the truth. Reagan and Carter, I think, are as bad as each other. I think Brzezinski is... Well, I don't know if I should say it on the air, but I think both of them are moving towards a nuclear war, and that's medically contraindicated.
Okay. We have time. We'll take another phone call. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. This is Jay Wilson. I'm an Episcopal minister and an English teacher, and I remember my 14-year-old son telling me that he wanted to be in the Air Force because he felt if he were several thousand feet up in the air, you'd last a little longer.
That's what the president's going to do, apparently. As soon as there's a nuclear war, that was discussed in our last conference in New York, he'll get it up in Air Force One, and it will be safer in the air. But then the question comes, where does he land?
Yeah, and I think you've described that landscape very effectively.
Yeah.
One of my sons is probably going into the Marine officer training if he can get the ROTC scholarship, and... Although nobody in my family is very happy about voting for Reagan or Carter for some of the reasons you've detailed, I wonder also if there isn't, however, a kind of rationale at least to try to avoid polarizing the country the way the Vietnamese War did, for trying to maintain some kind of parity in conventional armaments with the Soviet Union. I know what's involved with that, with defense contracts and defense lobby and all that. That kind of artificial momentum, but I wonder if there isn't still some argument for buying that kind of time.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I'm not so up in the air to think that men won't continue to fight as they always have. I think there'll continue to be wars.
Yeah.
But what we can't have now is a nuclear war, because war is no longer an option.
Yeah.
But I think there are new developments in conventional weapons. For instance, those smart weapons, they're bombs that seek out the exhaust heat of a tank or a
right.
plane. And that's why the Israeli-Egyptian war only lasted 6 days. You don't have to have nuclear weapons. If the Soviets started advancing with tanks into Europe, they could wipe them out uniformly.
Have you read World War III?
No. Well, I started reading it, but the logic was so ghastly by those generals, I just couldn't stand it. I guess I should have finished. I, as a woman and a doctor, reading that military stuff, it's like little boys playing war games, and it's the sort of thinking.
Well, this is power. This is the inflation and fascination with power and with technology, and you know that. And you use theological language in talking about it. Do you have, I don't want to you know, this may be irrelevant to what you're saying right now, so you don't have to answer it, but I wonder if you have some sort of theological commitment or feeling about it.
Well, I believe in God, and I believe that God is the life process, and as a physician, I have great reverence for that, and I desperately want it to continue, because I really love this planet very deeply, and I think we all do, and the greatest religious commitment that anybody on this earth can make right now is to commit their life to getting rid of those weapons so that our descendants can survive. That would be the most powerful religious commitment that any human being would ever make on earth, to devote their life to this. Now, if we all do that, of course we can survive. And I can't believe that God isn't on our side, that right and truth and love are not on our side, and surely they're more powerful than evil.
So thanks so much for your phone call.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. It's interesting to me that as you continue to fight against nuclear weapons and to try to inform people about the realities of the effects of nuclear weaponry, you also continue to work as a pediatrician. And in that capacity, you work with individual children.
I've just stopped.
Really?
Yeah, I've taken a leave of absence just in the last 2 weeks, and I feel terribly sad about it, and I'm grieving about leaving my patients that I adore. But I go to work, and I have a terrible conflict. I keep them alive for another 10 or 20 years. They have a serious illness called cystic fibrosis, only to be incinerated in a nuclear war. And for me, I know that what I must do is try and stop this, and for me that's the ultimate in preventive medicine. And there are 2,000 doctors now who feel like that. Some of them are giving up medicine. I'm not the only one to do this. Yeah.
So I'm sure
this is a medical issue. It's not political. It's medical, because our vocation is to protect and nurture life. We took the Hippocratic Oath, and that goes for every doctor in the world, including the Soviet doctors, with whom we're communicating very well.
What can we expect to see on television that you'll be working for in the near future? Because I know you've already said on the show today that you think that many people's opinions are affected by what they see on TV. You said if you could, you'd buy an advertisement in the middle of the General Hospital program, since so many women are watching who you feel you could reach if you were able to get the information in there. What are your plans for
Well, what
using
we must
media?
Do is get the evening news that most people watch to cover this. I would suggest that every person listening to this program call CBS and NBC immediately and ask not me, perhaps, but certainly Howard Hyatt, the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, or other very prestigious physicians, to be asked to, or Jack Geiger, who is in New York City, to talk about the medical effects of nuclear war. And it must become an issue that's discussed every night in the news to alert people. The presidential candidates must be confronted by the media, by the reporters. What are your opinions about this? George Bush says that nuclear war is survivable. When pushed, he said there'd be a 5% survivability in command and control. That's not very sane and rational thinking. So, and everybody also must write a letter today to their congressmen and senators, because Drinan said that he only receives about 3 letters a year about this subject. And unless they get letters, they don't act.
Okay. I'm going to give the address once again that you gave earlier. If you want to, and this is if you want to contact Helen Caldicott about any information about any of the groups that she mentioned about Physicians for Social Responsibility. It's 56 North Beacon Street, Watertown, Massachusetts. And should they address it to you if they want to contact you or any
of
the groups?
Yes, address it to me. And then also you can write to Women's International League for Peace and Freedom here in Philadelphia, and to the Mobilization for Survival Office. Both organizations here have a lot of literature you can obtain too.
Okay. I've been speaking with Helen Caldicott. She is a pediatrician, now on a leave of absence. She's the president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She's been traveling around the country and around the world trying to inform people about the real hazards of nuclear weapons and nuclear war. She's been organizing symposiums in different parts of the country, some of which you may have heard excerpted on All Things Considered, which are symposiums, again, to alert people on what they're calling the medical consequences of nuclear war. Helen Caldicott, it's been extremely interesting to have you here. Thank you very much for taking out some time and speaking with us on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.